Good evening and welcome to the Icecast. My name is Shane Chebsey, and on the Icecast we talk to comic artists, writers and publishers about their work, their lives and everything in between. And tonight on the Icecast I'm honoured to welcome Mr. Chris Starros. Hi Chris, how you doing?
You're doing great, man. Thanks for having me. This is awesome.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. As we were saying offline, it's been a long time since we've actually been able to catch up, and it's just nice. It's doing these podcasts is a really nice way of catching up with people that I haven't spoke to for a long time.
I know. Well, I tell you, the British comic scene was such a big part of my life. You and all the guys and gals over there. From 1998 to 2012, 2013, I came over to the British comics conventions 22 times, I think. Wow. You know, and I felt a real kinship and connection with that whole community over there. I mean, it's been a good 7 years or so since I've been back, and I miss it. You know, I love all the conventions over there, and I need to get back into it at some point, you know.
Yeah, definitely. You're always welcome. You know that. So what do you think the main difference is between like the UK scene and the American and sort of Canadian scene? Because they're all very different, aren't they? What would you say was the main sort of thing that separates?
Yeah, there is a different vibe. You know, I think the British comic scene didn't quite grow up with superheroes as much as the American scene. A little more sci-fi based. You know, you had you also had Danny and the Beano, and you had 2000. Mm. And all that kind of influences. And so there was a little bit of a different entry point for like a lot of the British community. And also I found that because of that, because they were a little into sci-fi, because they grew up with kids comics, because they grew up with other kinds of things, they're pretty open-minded crew. Like they're not as single-minded as a lot of American fans are. Marvel people, they're DC people, they're Star Wars people. You know, we're pretty dedicated, and I'm not immune to that either. If people know me, I'm a crazy Elvis fanatic, and so I've got that typical American tunnel vision too, you know. But the British always seem like, I read this kind of mainstream stuff, but I'll read a top shelf book too, like I'll check it out, and then they like it, you know. And so I found it a very robust community in the UK.
Yeah, well, that's nice to hear. I mean, because I always used to see you at the Bristol shows, and I'd be doing my table, you know, I'd be selling my Small Zone stuff, and which is mostly British indie stuff, but I did carry some American stuff. And you know, I'd come over to your table, usually at the end, you'd have a load of stuff going half price because you just didn't want to carry it home. I used to take advantage of that.
No, I mean, everything stayed in the UK one way or another. It was, you know, but what was nice is that there were several wholesalers out there. And also a real shout out to Nabil of the Traveling Man, you know, stores. And they were always very kind to buy a bunch of stuff on me at the end of shows, you know, and I had to offer some deep discounts so that they could stock up and keep our stuff.
That's cool.
Nabil was always very supportive. I really appreciated that. You know?
Yeah, I mean, Traveling Man always loved the more sort of left field, offbeat stuff. You know, I often found that they'd carry stuff that we had as well, and that was great. I think that was a reflection on Nabil, obviously, and the cities where they had those shops, they were good. You know, you had Bristol, and I think there was one in Leeds, Manchester, and they had those real sort of indie crowds and they did really well with those books, I think.
I think you really have to cultivate an indie crowd from the get-go.
Yeah.
If you don't, then you sort of chase them away before you have a chance to court them, and then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy at that point, you know, so you really got to make an effort. I mean, a lot of comics sell themselves because they're big brands, you know, like you don't have to do a lot of hand-selling on Batman stuff.
No.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or whatever, you know, people come for that because they're exposed to it in other ways. But if you're doing ground up indie stuff, a lot of the stuff that's at the conventions at those British scenes or the stuff that the indie publishers in America are doing as well, you know, you kind of got to hand sell it and get it started and get people into it, you know, where they can, you know, start looking for it on their own.
Yeah. You've got to hold the hand a little bit, haven't you? Just to give them that introduction. I mean, I didn't realize this, but I was doing a little bit of research about you, and you started publishing the same year that I did. It was 1994.
Yeah.
So going back a little bit there, aren't we, Chris?
Well, it's funny because like if you could go back in time and give your younger self any advice, it's hard to not think it would be, don't do it, go run, you know what I mean? Do something else with your life, for Christ's sake. Yeah. I mean, you know, you have to have a certain naivete to go into anything in life.
Yeah.
You won't do it. So having a lack of knowledge at the beginning is actually a good thing, because
it's essential.
Yeah. Because if you really knew what the glass ceiling was in the industry before you went into it, you would run, because you realized what an uphill battle it was. Though the truth is, at that time, I think I was well aware, my business partner, Brett Warnock, you know, my good friend, was well aware that comics needed a lot of work as an industry to re-legitimize itself as a literary art form, to expand borders, to get a wider audience, a more general audience, to get into bookstores, to package stuff that wasn't, you know, just for comic fans only. And then it would take a couple of generations to really make it mainstream. And that the people laying the groundwork for that were not the ones that were going to benefit from it financially.
That's true. That is so true.
They would have to pay your dues. And I'll joke, you know, based on that Saturday Night Live skit, which is like, Brett and I would one day be living in a van down by the river, and famous, very wealthy comic people will pull up in their Lamborghinis going, you guys were big inspiration to me at one time, because we're not going to be the ones that are going to cash in on it, you know?
Yeah, but yeah.
There was a lot of groundwork that had to be laid. Now, I feel like we were part of a movement, as you were, as the British scene was, to revive that whole thing. The British scene from that late 90s, when everything had really gotten quiet over there. I mean, you basically had one national show and it was on its way out. And now look what's happened to the UK. I mean, there's a dozen really vibrant shows all over the country. It's like, it's on fire. I mean, there's been a real renaissance the last 20 years in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, I saw it like firsthand, because when I started doing shows of my own in 2006, there was just us and Bristol. And I think Thought Bubble started the next year, and MCM was just starting up then. And that was it, really, because UCAC had finished, you know. And UCAC finished in 98. So there was Bristol was the only show for years. And now, when I went back into it, because I started doing Bix, and then I went back into it in 2014 with Ice, and there were like 60 shows a year.
It went a little wild there.
Crazy, absolutely crazy. But I think a lot of that was to do as well with the explosion of indie comics and small press comics, you know?
Yeah.
Because a lot of these shows, they wouldn't have existed. They wouldn't have been able to exist without that thriving indie scene, you know, that was created. And I was going to ask you, is the indie scene still as vibrant over there?
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's real big. You know, with the Small Press Expo in Bethesda, Maryland being one of the key conventions, MoCA in New York City is really huge. CAKE in Chicago is really huge. And then, of course, you have, you know, the big Comic-Con in San Diego, which caters to all forms of entertainment, you know, where comics seems to be a smaller part of it now, but still the fundamental foundation of it. And there's a lot of indie talent there every year as well, so it's very vibrant, and it seems bigger than ever. I mean, you know, it seems like comics generations turn around about every 5 years, that there's culture related, you know, like when you're in high school and you heard a band for 4 years, it feels like forever, but from the outside you realize that whole movement ended in 4 years, you know. Yeah. And all those cool clothes you have just ain't cool no more, right?
But you still wear them.
You know, that just, but so the comics generations change, and they each have their own agenda and their own kind of stories and kind of art styles. And you can see patterns emerging in there, especially as you get older and you sort of step away from it a little bit. But, you know, in the small press community now, there's a whole bunch of vibrant people, and it's their show now. I mean, I sometimes walk around it, and even though we're still putting out 20 really vibrant books a year, doing a lot of good stuff and helping expand the borders of comics to the mainstream world. You know, sometimes I feel like a dinosaur walking around those indie shows, because, you know, the people there are a third of my age.
Yeah, I know the feeling. It's getting like that for me.
and happily oblivious to some of those predecessor issues, right? And just doing their own thing and in love with each other. And I know it, they're in that summer of love zone where everything is right with the world and they're enjoying the hell out of it, you know? So I got no problems with that.
Oh, yeah. It's nice to see it, isn't it? I mean, you remember it yourself when you were in that stage. But obviously, I mean, for yourself, comics was a late love, wasn't it? You were an adult, weren't you, when you really got into comics?
I know. Isn't that sad? It's like picking up smoking later in life.
Well, I did that.
Tragic.
So. I think I was 21 when I started smoking. What a stupid thing to do.
Yeah, my first love was always music and still is. So when I was a kid, I just wanted to be a rock star so bad, you know. So I grew up loving hard rock and heavy metal, and I played in a lot of bands and nightclubs for 12 years when I was younger. I know if you see photos of me now, it's hard to imagine, but there was a time, you know, when I had hair and eyesight and hearing. And
I know what you mean.
75 pounds lighter and everything else. But, you know, and I did that for a long time. But around 1989, I finally gave up the ghost on the metal stuff just because, you know, grunge was coming in. The styles were changing, you know, and it wasn't like I was going to be learning new tricks. You know what I mean? Yeah. I'd just be chasing culture and not helping define it, you know. At that point.
Yeah, so,
And my hearing was shot. I mean, from playing
all that loud music.
Yeah, it's bad. And then I was really bored. You know, I had a good day job. I was working in the software industry and all that. But I really wanted a creative outlet, and I had none. And, I eventually, a couple years later, in my 30s, you know, discovered Alan Moore's V for Vendetta. And that blew my mind. Like, I didn't think comics could be that good. I thought they were kind of juvenile in a way. I remember when I was little, my parents told me that books with pictures in them were for kids and books with words in them were for adults. And so, you know, I was afraid to grow up that I missed the whole comics phase. I just went straight to the Lord of the Rings and Doom, Shogun, like any books that were like 3 inches thick. I just thought, well, this means I'm grown up, even though I'm 11, right? You know?
Yeah. That's ingrained, isn't it? I mean, if it is ingrained by your parents or by your peers, it's really hard to break that view, I would imagine. I mean, it's a view I never had because I think I started reading comics as soon as I could read. I was about 4 years old when I read my first comic. But I would imagine that if that's ingrained into you, that, you know, text is good and pictures are bad, you know, that sticks, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, I was trying really hard to impress, if you know what I mean. So I was trying to read the big books and all that sort of thing. And then, so I missed comics entirely. So it wasn't until in my 30s where I read V for Vendetta. I'm like, wow, I didn't know art, you know, words and pictures just could juxtapose each other in a way to be high art and high literature at the same time. And I said, wow, there was a lot on her. And then I sort of dove in and did my own like personal master's program, you know what I mean? Like, I read thousands of books, a lot of the Smithsonian stuff, you know, just wanted to wrap my hands around the industry. And then eventually I decided, you know what, I kind of have an epiphany, like I want to jump in, you know, like I did when I heard my first Black Sabbath album as a kid and I wanted to play guitar, you know, like it was the same sort of thing. But I knew to draw, like I had no drawing talent. I still draw the same house and inbirds and my mom and dad in the front yard that I did when I was 3. Like, there's been so I knew that wasn't gonna happen, and so I had to kind of find my place. I didn't know what it would be at first, you know. And it turned out that editing and publishing really fit my style, which was there's a creative half to that, and then there's sort of a straight up business side to that. And I am a decent mix of both, you know, and it sort of seemed to play well. And then it evolved into that eventually. And, you know, and then I, unlike music, kind of comics kind of worked out. Like, I never made it in music, but comics, I don't know if made is the right word. I have survived in comics.
Well, you've been around a while, you know. I mean, you've published, what is it? Something like 400 books or something?
Yeah, 400 graphic novels. Yeah. And it's been like 27 years, you know, in the game. And about 22 of that was full time, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that was my only source of revenue, you know. And, you know, it's been a good run. I can't complain.
Definitely. I mean, how did it click for you? I mean, what was it? I mean, obviously, you decided you wanted to do comics. And sort of going back to the beginning there, what was it that sort of made you decide your direction and which artists and writers you wanted to work with? Did things present themselves, or did you go searching for certain people?
Well, I think the first thought I had in my head was that I would be a journalist or something.
Right. You know,
I would try to write some articles for people and such, but there was a naive because I really wasn't, I mean, I'm a decent writer. Okay. I can write a business thing, you know, I can write an article, but I didn't really have the seasoning and research and connections in the industry to be a thing. I was a complete outsider. I'll tell you how naive I was. There was such a thing as a fan convention. I didn't even know conventions existed. Like, I was completely outside of that world. Wow. I read the comics in isolation, and I was getting up to speed on the industry. And then I decided, okay, I started visiting the local comic book shops in area. This was in Atlanta at the time. And there was really only one store in town that had sort of an indie focus. The rest did not. And so I started mailing a lot of books because I realized it was the literary stuff that interested me, you know, all respect to the superhero stuff that just seemed a little bit young for me and where it was targeting. And I read a lot of French literature. I was very literary in the prose world as well. So I was looking for things that would hit me on that level. And so I started doing a lot of mail order with Fantagraphics and a lot of self-publishers and indie stuff. And because I have such a crap memory, I always took notes with everything. So I'd remember, did I like this book? Why did I like it? You know, and all those kind of stats. And eventually I thought, the journalistic stuff wasn't going to work because I didn't have the connections or the thing, but my opinions on what I thought was good and what I thought wasn't, I thought at some point that might be useful because every time I went to a comic book store, they were not carrying the stuff that I thought was good. I mean, you could Spider-Man there, but you could buy Love and Rockets in a lot of stores, and that was a no-brainer. Like, that was a indie title, you know?
Yeah.
And that was still at the time when I didn't even know there were such things as zines, like do it yourself, whatever. So that was the epiphany, which was like, oh my God, people just staple shit together and out there. You know, like, you don't need a publisher. You know what? You don't need somebody else to vouch for you. You just do it yourself. And so the first step is to just have the confidence to get something out there. And the next step is to have the humility to know that the next thing you do is going to be a lot better. Because hopefully in retrospect, the last thing he did was like, oh my God, I'm so embarrassed. That was such crap, you know.
But it's always the way, isn't it?
But if you didn't have the courage to get that first thing out there, you would have never gone anywhere. It would just be polishing that original turd over and over and over in your head. You'd never take the step to embed yourself with all the lessons you need to learn by repetitive creative process, you know. Yeah. So I started a little zine called The Stardust Report, cleverly using my name in the title to have less things for people to remember, right? And
then, less for you to remember as well.
Yeah, exactly. With my crap memory, if I looked at it, at least I did that right. Yeah. And I just started reviewing books in it, you know, things that I thought were the best. Basically, it was a blog. It is weird that you could go back to the late 90s and predate email and the internet. Like, it's not that long ago, but it's just arcane, you know?
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? How in such a relatively short space of time, really, the world of publishing and communications has just completely changed, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, you know? And so I remember, like, at that time, putting those little store support zines out. The first one was 8 pages of notebook paper stapled in the upper left-hand corner. And literally, it was like a high school report. Nobody that one. There are only 40 copies, thank God. Okay. And then there was the second one was, you know, like a 6x9 saddle stitch, you know, offset print thing where I printed 2,000 of them with crappy cover on it.
That's a lot. I mean, that is a lot of copies, isn't it? You know, for something like that.
Yeah. You tell me about it, right? Well, you know, the old saying, a publisher's basement is always overflowing with optimism, right? You know.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I took those things and I thought, well, you know, nobody's going to buy this thing. There was a $2 cover price on it. But I said, well, nobody's going to buy it. They don't know who I am. I don't know. Again, before I knew about conventions still. Okay. All right. So I took these things and I did my research where were the best comic book shops in the country and in the UK and in the US. So Page 45, you know, Gosh, Millionaire Picnic in America, The Beguiling in Canada, you know, like I picked about 50 stores that I heard were really good. And I put 20 copies of each of the zine together. and mailed them to them and said, it's a gift for your store. Put them on the shelves, sell them. And if they sell, you make $40, keep the money or throw them away if you don't want to put them on your shelves because you're embarrassed by them. So they actually started selling, quote unquote, around the world. You know what I mean? Because people just put the free money on their shelves and see if they would sell. And I actually sold them and started getting a lot of mail to my P.O. box. And one of them was from a guy who bought a copy at Big Planet Comics in Washington, D.C., owned by Joel and Greg Bennett, who have been lifelong friends of mine in the industry. And a guy by the name of Chris Orr, I don't know if you have heard the name before, Chris Orr, he's now in another industry entirely, I think, right, working overseas. But at the time, he turned out to be a really big player in the small press expo community back then. And he was the one, he wrote me an 11-page rebuttal to my zine, handwritten.
Okay? 11 pages?
11-page rebuttal to my zine. And it was hilarious. It was dead on point. And he was making fun of me and complimenting me at the same time, right? You know, and it's a total fanboy exchange. And so I decided, you know, there's too much here to talk about. So I wasn't going to write him back. I just looked him up in the phone book and called him.
Why?
And we had a great conversation and we hit it off. We became friends. And he said, dude, you should bring your zine up to the Small Press Expo. It's going to be in another month or so. And that was the second Small Press Expo, the very second one. Wow. And he said, come, Dave Sim will be here. He's a guest. You know, you could meet some of these guys. And I go, dude, my zine is so bad. Nobody's going to buy it. He goes, are you kidding me? You should see the crap of these things. People will buy your zine, you know? So I flew up there, crashed at his house, did the thing, sold 100 copies of my zine.
That's, you know, impressive. Yeah.
$2 a pop at this thing, right? And my wallet was full with $200 of drinking money and stuff.
I was going to say, did it all go back behind the bar?
Yes. If you know me, it always does, right? I never drink alone, so everybody's drinking with me. You know? And that's what started my knowledge and awareness of the convention scene. And so I started working on the next Star Wars report. And that one, I had always been a really huge fan of Eddie Campbell and all of his work that he had done in the UK, even was done remotely from Australia when he was living there for a while, you know?
Yeah.
Now he's here in Chicago in America. But he was all of his Alec and Bacchus stories, you know, unrelated to From Hell, his personal work. When I started really diving into it and researching it, I realized he had a master plan for all of it. It was all sequential, even though there were a lot of short stories that stood alone. He was telling a very long master tale with these things. Yeah. It's just really collected in any real great way. I mean, there was a few trade paperbacks here, but the volume of material he had was tremendous. So I had done this crazy map of how to read his stuff in order, you know, like, and how.
Wow, that's quite an undertaking.
Yeah. And I was like, and so I did an interview with him, and I asked him if he would do an interview, and we did an interview together, and I transcribed it. So that was going to be the big feature of the next one. Again, I'm expanding my idea of what the zine was going to be. And it also had a lot of tutorials and stuff like, here's the 100 best stores to sell your stuff in. Here's how you buy stuff. You know, here's how much postage you put in the mail, the Fantagraphics. These are the books you should buy. Here's the distributors you call to get your books listed, you know, all that kind of information, like a do-it-yourself self-publishing.
Yeah, we needed something like that then as well, both sides of the pond, because, you know, the internet wasn't there, at least, well, it was, but, you know, it wasn't really being utilized, and people were dying for that information, weren't they?
Yeah, so that it turned out to be a fairly promising thing, and in fact, at the time, the cover artist that I had lined up for that particular zine fell through. And so Eddie had called me one day and said, so when's this thing coming out? I go, well, it was going to the printer tomorrow, but my cover artist, I guess, don't have no fear. I'll send you a cover.
Oh.
About a week later via FedEx, not only did that iconic cover of the Bacchus, the Pantheon, Star Report show up, he gave me the original.
Wow.
He sent the disc with the scans on him, and he had his designer put all the logos and titling on it and send me 4 sheets of film. Back then, it wasn't digital. You had to have film, right?
Yeah, yeah.
already done the color separations. The film was there. So all I need to do is forward that to the printer and they could roll the presses. So, right. You know, so we had developed a friendship at that time. This very, very good friendship from across the pond. He was in Australia. Mm-hmm. And that was the time he started to self-publish. And he honestly needed a place to store his books, right? Because he was printing in Canada, living in Australia, selling primarily to an American and UK market. Yeah. And he needed some place to sell the bulk of his stuff, which was to the American markets. And so I volunteered. And so as I started going to conventions again, now I was selling two or three episodes of the Star Wars Report, all of Eddie's self-published stuff, his Bacchus, his Alex stuff. And I was starting to understand how publishing starts to work for my own stuff and from working with other people's books. And then one thing led to another. I started doing a lot of conventions. I met Brett Warnock on the circuit. He was a real cool cat, a lot of great design abilities, lot of connections within that deep part of the American indie scene. And I thought, you know what, we might make a good team. And we became really good friends. And I proposed, let's do this together. And that's how Top Shelf formed, was on a couch at the SPX at Chris Orr's house in 97. Wow. And after we'd been on the circuit for a couple of years selling our own independent wares separately, Top Shelf was born. And then, you know, I think our first book, the first graphic novel we published was Pete Sickman Garner's Hey Mister, which is still a classic, the after school special. And it's fucking hilarious. And he's always been one of my favorite creators in the Top Shelf pantheon, you know, and that's where it all kind of began. That was the first graphic novel. And here it is, you know, 20 something years later, 400 graphic novels later.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. It's an incredible achievement, Chris. It really is. I mean, some of my favorite graphic novels of all time came out through, you know, Top Shelf. From Hell is probably my favorite graphic novel of all time. I absolutely adore that. You know, you mentioned Eddie Campbell and Alan Moore already. Right. And it's just an absolute masterpiece. And I also love the humor stuff. And you were saying about stuff being funny. I love Jeffrey Brown. How did that come about, you're working with Jeffrey Brown?
Well, you know, I tell you because, you know, when people are out there working comics, you know, now that everything's so digital. And of course, now with the whole pandemic issue where nobody's traveling, you're really only to work one side of that street, which is sort of your social media presence, you know. Yeah. But I was always an old school rocker. I understood touring. I understood getting out on the road. And so I really wanted to meet people, make those personal connections, sell stuff, but also get connected with people. Because again, that was my summer of love. That's when everybody was fascinating to me. And I wanted to get to know everybody. And so a lot of personal relationships were formed. And, you know, at the height of Top Shelf, I was doing 21 conventions a year. I mean, I was at one every other week, you know? And so you get to meet a lot of people, you get to know a lot of people, and you get to see people several times a year, especially on the American side of the pond. And so, you know, I ended up developing a friendship with Jeffrey Brown, really loved his indie stuff. And he had already self-published Clumsy and done really well with it. And when he was getting to his second book, he was looking for some kind of partner to help with the logistics of all of that. And so he partnered with us. And I think we ended up doing about 15, you know, really strong indie books with Jeffrey Brown before he sort of became famous doing the Darth Vader and Son books, the Jedi Academy stuff, you know, and just taking over the world with his humor side of things.
Well, it's so funny, you know, and it's funny because it's relatable, a lot of it.
Yeah.
You know, even the more pop culture stuff, you know, I remember reading one of my favorites that still has me in stitches. It was the Incredible Change Bots.
Yeah.
You know, the take on Transformers. It's just hilarious.
Yes, and it is. We did three graphic novels with that. They are great. They're just, they're wonderful.
It was a real discovery for me. And obviously I've got you to thank for that. You know, I probably would never have discovered those books if it wasn't for waiting for you to start selling at half price at Bristol.
Yeah, I did sell a lot of books at half price over the years. I wanted them out of my basement. I wanted them in people's hands. I'd sell them whatever it took to get them in people's hands. You know, the interesting thing about Jeffrey Brown creatively, you know, how talented he is. Like he draws his pages to size. You know, they're not reduced, if you know what I mean.
They are
see they are, generally speaking, he works at 100%, right? So his pages are tiny. So what he usually does is he has a sketchbook. So yeah. Like, you know, Incredible Changemakers, Incredible Changebots 1, right? He opens it up, he freaking draws the cover. He turns a page, he draws, starts writing and drawing page 1. And he's so talented that there's literally no corrections, no edits, no skipped pages, no duplicate pages. It's just page 1 to page 150. He draws them, and then he goes, and then he scans them in individually, an original volume somewhere. And I'm sitting down. And what's crazy is he could be at a convention while he's working. And, you know, there's lots of dead times at conventions. Yeah. Lonely and wishing somebody would come and say hello.
Yeah, I've had a few like that. I've had a few of those.
And instead of the look of desperation appearing on his eyes and his heart, like, he would just put his nose down and start drawing. And by the end of the weekend, he'd be 40 pages into a graphic novel, fully colored.
Oh, that's incredible.
See, his efficiency was unparalleled. Like, only maybe like Nate Powell and the Top Shelf Stable was, you know, who could kick out 10 March pages a week, you know, that kind of thing. Like, some of those guys are just prolific in ways that other cartoonists. For, you know,
and it is incredible, isn't it, the rate of work for some of these guys. And Nate Powell actually was another one I was going to highlight, because you won an award, didn't you, you guys, with one of Nate's books.
Well, that was the first March, which, you know, was written by Congressman John Lewis and Andrew Iden, and drawn by Nate Powell, was the first graphic novel in America that won a National Book Award. Very first novel. And then that was a big deal. And Nate is the artist on all three of those volumes, and did an amazing job, you know, absolutely amazing job.
Yeah, beautiful stuff. I mean, I love Nate Powell's inking style. You know, it's like, it's so sometimes so delicate and so fluid, and yet it's so expressive as well, so stylized. It's just all those magical components. Everything I love about great comics seems to inhabit his work. Absolutely incredible. So going forward a little bit, you met up with Brett Warnock, you formed Top Shelf Productions, and you brought out a hell of a lot of books, won some awards. And then you also went on a little bit of a mission, I guess, to teach people about comics and about the potential of comics. And you've done a little bit of lecturing, I believe, as well.
Well, I have a little bit. At some point I started teaching at the Savannah College of Art and Design. There's a university here that had an Atlanta campus, even though their big campus is in Savannah, Georgia. But
wow, that's a bit of a distance.
It's in Atlanta. And I did about 30 classes there, you know, one a quarter over a long period of time. I stopped doing that a couple of years back when I moved, but, you know, I did that for a very long time. I do speak at universities from time to time, you know, and do classroom visits, and do a lecture kind of on the business of comics, the business of art, you know, because a lot of people teach you how to draw, but they don't teach you how to get out there and make it happen for yourself. And there's more how to do that with than ever before. And I think most of the young creators know that instinctively, like, they got to work their social media and all that kind of thing. But there's a lot of ins and outs to the business of art that maybe they don't know. And I don't think they get taught a lot. And since I have a lot of experience in that, it seemed useful. So I'll tend to go into a university for like 2 or 3 days, do a 3 or 4 hour lecture. The great horrible truth is, within 3 hours, I can tell you everything I know. That's it.
The entirety of your knowledge, 3 hours.
All I have is 3 hours of info. That's it. You know, I'll leave you hanging like there's more wisdom there behind the curtain. But the truth, that's all there is. It takes a lifetime to season that information, to understand it, to make it your own. But seriously, I can tell you everything I know in 3 years. And then what I would do is do one-on-one portfolio reviews with everybody there, and just really sit down and find the highlights of people's work, find the things that they could work on a little bit from a storytelling point of view, from art point of view, and try to help them move forward. And as an editor and publisher, and Top Shelf's always been very hands-on with those things, trying to make stories better,
I always got that impression with your books, actually, that you put out, is that there's a little piece of you in all of them. You know, you're not just getting the work, putting it out. It always feels like you've had this creative involvement.
It's, yes, in some ways. I mean, like, I never tried to insert myself just for my own ego's sake. Like if somebody turned something and it was perfect, I left it alone. You know, Jeffrey Brown's work as an example was always came in, you know, flawless, really touched it. You know, Craig Thompson's Blankets came in perfect, but his first book, Goodbye Chunky Rice, did not. And I actually worked with him a lot to change that. And he actually redrew half of that book before.
Wow.
But Blankets was just a masterpiece from the word go.
And it's incredible. It's incredible. And the design on that, I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, the books look beautiful.
And that was all Craig. And when I read the thumbnails on Blankets back, I guess, around 2000, 2001, you know, somewhere around there, I knew that it was going to be the book of the decade. I already knew that. And I spent an enormous amount of time marketing it to get the industry ready for it, because when it came out, I knew it was going to be huge. And then it took off slowly. Things move slowly in indie world, but when it started rolling, it became a huge, and it really inspired a whole generation of indie creators. And it also was one of those pivotal books that wasn't serialized first. It came out as a graphic novel, and it wasn't just a graphic novel, it was a 600-page, $30 graphic novel.
Yeah, it's a big one, you know? I mean, you needed to really want to read that, because it wasn't cheap.
But and it was one of those books that helped break into the book trade, too. Like, it helped. That was about the time when the book trade started to get interested in comics, not just comic book shops, but, you know, your Barnes & Nobles, your Borders, your libraries, your all kinds of things, you know? I mean, it's predated Amazon a little bit, but and then that book was one that proved to buyers at the book trade, you know, amongst a lot of others, but it was one of those books that contributed to people going, oh, this is a real something, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I had great feedback on that book. I mean, because I used to buy it from you and sell it on in the UK, and I could never afford to buy too many copies, but I always used to buy them, you know, because whenever I went to a convention, you could guarantee if I had copies of Blankets, it would sell. Right. And I would always get people coming back as well at the convention saying, I read Blankets. That was amazing. It really had a huge impact on a lot of people. And I think, you know, you were saying it inspired a lot of people. I would totally agree with that. I think for a lot of people, it showed them the potential of the medium, as in you can tell these long form, character driven stories about real people. And there's a market for it. That market had to be established. And it's like going back to what we were saying before. And you started doing what you were doing, the Fantagraphics were doing what they were doing, and obviously the guys here in the UK, that market had to be created, didn't it? It had to be, people had to be, you know, they had to realize that potential was there. We sort of had a whole hand, you know, and it wasn't easy.
If you go back to like the mid-80s when like Watchmen, Mouse and The Dark Knight returned, those created a lot of press, at least in America, maybe in the UK, the same one.
They did.
But about like the legitimacy of comics as an art form, because those were all three very high art, very quality titles, you know. But it wasn't a lot of graphic novels behind those three to back it up. You know, like all of a sudden, if the whole industry goes, let's put these in the mainstream bookstores, like what else you got? Well, we got these Spider-Man comics. What you mean? But if you look at what the people were doing in the 80s and 90s with, you know, Fantagraphics and the whole indie community here and over in the UK, by the late 90s, there was a plethora of literary graphic novels all over the place. So around 2000, when From Hell and Blankets, from Top Shelf's point of view, was pushing in that market, and Drawn and Quarterly was doing stuff, Fangraphs doing stuff, and pushing into that market. And it got reignited again. And then they said, it's like, we got tons of stuff, all right? There's tons of literary work here that we can push behind it. And that's when the industry was truly born, you know, when a cataclysm of things, that having that much product behind it to substantiate the industry this time. And also that nerd culture became so cool. Like a lot of younger people who were kind of into nerdy things now were in positions of power to review things in entertainment magazines, to make buying decisions at stores and chains, you know, and pull the stuff in. That sort of changed things a little bit, you know, and while Top Shelf was just a part of that whole movement, I feel good about the fact that we were part of a way that helped legitimize comics to the world outside of fandom. And that was my mission from the get-go. That was mine and Brett's mission from the get-go. I feel good that we were a little bit of a part of that. As you were, as everybody sitting at the tables in the British comic scene was, we were all part of that together, you know. That was important.
I agree totally. Yeah, and yeah, I think you and Brett, you know, you were giants in that. You know, your contribution to that was absolutely huge. Obviously, something else I wanted to talk about before we wrap up, because unbelievably we've been chatting for 45 minutes. It's just incredible, isn't it? How it goes.
Yeah, I know. Time moves.
You also I want to get this right. I have got it written down here because I always forget the letters. It was the Comic Book Legal Defense
Fund, yes.
CBLDF. It's like, I never remember it. you were on the board of that for between 2004 and 2009, I believe.
Yeah.
What made you want to decide to do that?
Well, you know, when I first joined comics, I remember going to the conventions, and I remember Dennis Kitchen and Neil Gaiman, a lot of others working on the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund issues, where free speech and parody and obscenity, as if somebody draws something that's obscene or something and then gets arrested in a local municipality for pornography, that needs to be defended. It's just ink on paper. It's expression. So we need to protect those free speech rights. So there was a lot of problems at that time with those issues. I believed in the mission strongly. And I remember writing Dennis Kitchen a letter way back in the days, like in the 90s, saying, just join the industry as a fledgling publisher. I said, I know I haven't earned my place in this industry yet, but one day if I do, I would love to sit on the board and help drive the First Amendment agenda here in America, because this is an important mission for me. He remembered that letter. He was, you know, I've spent a lot of time trying to make it well-written, you know, and and then we, of course, ran into each other since I was doing a lot of these conventions together, you know.
Yeah.
And we became very friendly. And eventually a seat on the board opened up. I joined. And then one day, Dennis Kitchen retired, and they needed a new chairman. And I think everybody took one step back, and I was too stupid to, you're right, and I became.
No one else wanted to do it.
Yeah. I became the chairman for a while. And during that time, you know, we had several cases, and we won all of them, and a lot of good things was done. I mean, later, that was a great experience for when we published Alan Moore's Lost Girls, which was one of the biggest epic free speech battles I've ever done. And truthfully, it's my proudest moment in publishing, because a bigger publisher wouldn't have taken it on for legal reasons, and a smaller publisher couldn't have afforded to do it. And we were in that sweet spot where we were willing to risk everything to put out Alan Moore's magnum opuses. And I remember convincing Alan and Melinda to finish the project. It took 6 years to finish it. And then when it was all said and done, we had to fight free speech issues everywhere, legal issues everywhere. I had to battle Canadian customs in a court of law. I had to battle the Great Orleans Children's Hospital, you know, and come to a settlement with them.
I remember all that in the news.
Issues. And to be able to get the book distributed worldwide. But it was an important mission, because even though it's a pornography, it's a very thinking person's pornography about women coming to terms with bad events that have happened to their lives and finding redemption through each other and becoming whole again, and juxtaposing also sex against war, and really understanding that war is the true pornography, not sexual human contact.
Yes.
And Alan Moore it's a masterpiece of a book. Of course, some people could get offended by it. It is over the top in ways. He actually builds it on a crescendo to absurdity, and makes a lot of subtle and a lot of overt points while he's doing it. He balances that thing between pornography and literacy and literary issues so well. It's something that's never been done before in most any medium, I think. And that was a really big, important project for me.
Yeah, I remember when it came out. I mean, I've still got my copy, and the nice big slipcase one. It was absolutely beautiful. I remember because it was obviously billed as, you know, literary pornography, but I don't find it pornographic, you know, because to me, the whole meaning of pornography is that it's gratuitous. You know, like gratuitous violence is pornography. Where, you know, to me, you know, that was my take on it. And yes, it pushes the boundaries, and I can see how some people may be offended by it. But I actually found it quite beautiful as a book, you know, and as a story, and quite moving at times as well.
Yeah. You know? And I'll tell you, my very favorite moment in comics ever was a moment with Alan Moore dealing with that book. After about 5 or 6 years, Melinda had finally finished the artwork.
Right.
Her artwork was humongous in size. Her original pages are taller than small children. I mean, it's really big pages.
Oh, I didn't realize it was so large.
And there were only a couple, because of its pornographic nature, we couldn't ship it across the borders. So we had to come to the UK to scan it. And there was only 3 or 4 drum scanners in London that were big enough to scan those pages. And only one of them was affordable enough for us to use because they were cool. They were artsy people and they understood what we were trying to do.
Yeah.
And they
did
hours rates. If we'd show up after hours, they would help us scan them and, you know, cut rate prices, you know.
That's great.
All of the artwork was in these folders, and it was, I don't know, about 12 inches thick, maybe, you know, all the artwork together. And Melinda and Brett were out somewhere running some errands, and I'm sitting in Alan Moore's living room with him, and none of the work's lettered at that point. There's no lettering on the artwork. And he goes, and Alan Moore's voice, which I can't do, but he was like, Chris, would you like to hear the story of Lost Girls? And I said, absolutely, Alan. And he turns in the majestic way that only Alan can do. He opens the page of the book like, you know, a great grim war. And, and he narrates page by page the entire saga of Lost Girls for me.
The very
first reading of Lost Girls was an oral reading from Alan Moore to an audience of one that was me. Okay?
That is so cool. Moment. Oh, Chris, that is beyond cool, isn't it? I mean, that is something very, very special. I mean, in the world of comics, that's like you're Moses and you've just received the Ten Commandments.
Exactly. So my favorite moment in my whole career, absolutely. You
know, that is a great story, Chris. That is absolutely amazing.
So yeah, that was important. That was an important book for me. I mean, we've done, you know, like you're not going to be remembered for very few things, very, very few things in your life, you know, and March from Hell and Blankets and Essex County and Lost Girls and a handful of other books. Maybe people remember Top Shelf 4, but that's good enough, man. Those were high points. And I'm lucky to have crossed paths with the creators that were willing to work with us to do those projects together. It was a great honor for sure.
Oh, I'm sure, mate. I'm sure. And yeah, and you know, you talk about the Essex County books. That's another set of books that, you know, I absolutely adored. It was Jeff Lemire, wasn't it?
Right.
And you look at what he's doing now, the breadth of work.
He's just on fire. Like, and he's so hardworking and such a nice guy. Like, he's, you know, like I understand that Top Shelf is a stepping stone for a lot of people as they move up through their careers, right? Yeah. I get that. Being an Elvis fan, I understand the difference between Sun Records and RCA, even though I compare myself to Sun in quality, but I get the stepping stone part, the metaphor, right? You know,
yeah.
They're no way compared to Top Shelf. But guys like Jeffrey Brown and Jeff Lemire and others really always had a lot of respect for where they came from. You know, they still published their original books with us. There's still doors open to maybe do more stuff down the road together, you know, and we've stayed friends. And I've really enjoyed that aspect of a lot of the Top Shelf creators, you know, that they may have moved on to bigger things here and there, but there's still a real good rapport with us. Yeah.
And they're not forgetting their roots, basically, and, you know, how they got there. And I think, you know, it's nice to be grounded like that, isn't it? You know, when we've created, because, you know, some creators, they lose touch of that if they're very successful. Not many, though. I have found, obviously, through doing the conventions, I've encountered a lot of creators who were, you know, small press, then indie, and then, you know, catapulted into stardom, if you like.
Right.
And for the most part, I have found most of their egos are still in check, you know.
Yeah, comics is a very good community that really supportive of each other. And I think for the most part, there's a few bad actors in the game, but for the most part, everybody's really great people in comics. You know?
Yeah, I found that. I was talking to someone else, actually, a writer I know. We were recording another show like this, and Mike Garley, and we had the same conversation actually there. We were both talking about how, you know, the comics community for the most part is full of really nice people, you know?
Yeah.
You can get the odd bad apple, but you get that everywhere, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. And we all know who they are. We all know, and we don't need to name names. So going a little, because we're getting near the end, so
okay.
I'll try to wrap everything up.
No worries, man. I'm enjoying this.
Yeah, it's been awesome, mate. It's been really good. Top Shelf eventually became part of IDW, didn't it?
Yes.
A few years ago, you merged with those guys, but you're still involved, right? And then you're still pushing stuff. You're still putting stuff out.
Yeah, I think, you know, because I started late in the game, you know, now I'm almost 60 now, right? And
wow. You don't look it, mate. You don't look it.
I know. Well, it's crazy, right? But I realized that, you know, a handful of years ago that I just couldn't be unloading semi-trucks anymore into warehouses, driving to 21 shows a year, unloading boxes and stuff. I needed some logistical support.
Yeah, because comics are heavy, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And I was working, you know, 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, you know, to keep Top Shelf going. And it was relentless. And I realized I wanted to stay in comics and still do Top Shelf, but I needed to offload some things. So I ended up courting a few people, and IDW ended up being the perfect marriage. I joined up with IDW. They basically acquired Top Shelf. And then with the idea that I would run it for them and be able to do, and part of the deal was I could run it from them from any location, that I could just be mobile,
yeah,
and not have to be in their office per se and just run it remotely. Now everybody works remote, but then yeah, that was more of a deal, right? And so that's been 6 years now that we've been with IDW. But
has it been that long? God, that's gone quick.
Yeah, it's been 6 years. We've published a ton of books through them, and they have let Top Shelf stay Top Shelf and be Top Shelf. We still make, me and Lee Walton, you know, who's my right-hand man at Top Shelf, he and I make the editorial decisions together. We pull in the talent. We work with them editorially. We get the books out. And then we used IDW's amazing staff to help get everything sorted and everything out. I mean, there's so much of the logistics that I can just say forward to somebody whose job is to do that, and they do it so well, you know.
Yeah.
And they've got a great crew, and it's been a real great relationship. And so now I can still work in the industry for another decade, and when it's time for me to leave, there's not this great albatross to sort out.
I just walk off
and walk into the sunset, you know.
Can you imagine yourself leaving altogether, Chris? I mean, you know, can you?
I don't know. I don't really see it as work. I don't really, yeah. I know it is work. It's hard work, but I don't really see it as work. I think I could stay involved for quite some time, you know, not really have to retire, but I could see at some point where maybe I'm slightly less involved, where I'm, you know, not doing as many projects a year or whatever.
Yeah.
Or maybe more on a consulting basis or something. But I'm not. Right now, I've still got a good another decade in me for sure. I'll keep running.
I'm glad to hear it, mate. I'm really glad to hear that.
if the economies survive and everything, and we all survive individually as well, you know, who knows?
Yeah, well, the future is never certain, is it?
But no.
I find that, you know, when you love something like this, the idea of not doing it anymore, it's sort of like, well, what's the point if you're not doing what you love, you know?
Yeah. No, the whole IDW thing helped me be able to keep it going and re-energize myself, because I think I was reaching the end of my energy rope at some point.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It allowed me to take a whole new start, but actually stay in the same place at the same time. So it was a good life decision for me. And we've done, you know, at least 150 books since then. So there's a lot of stuff to look forward to there too.
Yeah, I mean, the quality has not suffered at all, you know. I mean, that's the great thing about IDW, you know, their quality of print and the presentation has always been really impressive. I remember when they were doing the stuff with Ashley Wood, you know, Zombies versus Robots and all that. They were beautiful books to look at. The paper quality,
absolutely,
and the presentation and the design. So when I heard that, you know, you guys were teaming up with IDW, I thought that's actually a really good team up. You know, the sensibilities are there. You know, they match. Mm-hmm. So it's a really nice development. So okay, we've hit the hour, Chris. unbelievably, and we've managed to not go on about Elvis, because I was warned.
I'm so disappointed in you.
I was warned by a couple of friends that they said, "Don't start talking about Elvis. If you start talking about Elvis, you won't stop him."
That's right. Whatever you do, stay away. I get it. It's I hate to say it, but your friends warned you correctly. You were well warned.
But I'm an Elvis fan too. But if we got started, it would be another bloody hour. Yeah,
that'd be another hour there for sure. I hear you.
But honestly, Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure to catch up with you. It really has. And to share,
next time it needs to be in a pub in England.
Yes.
We're hanging out together. That's what I'd prefer. You know?
That would be absolutely wonderful, mate. Thank you so much for joining me tonight. It's been an absolute pleasure. It really has. So hope everything goes well. And I hope that, you know, we see lots more books from you, and I'll certainly be picking them up. So for tonight, I will say thank you and good night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.